Welcome to the Kindling's Muse podcast, an intelligent, imaginative, hospitable exploration of ideas that matter in contemporary life. And now, here's your host, Dick Staub.
This is Dick Staub, your host. I want to welcome you to the Kindling's Muse at Earl Palmer Ministries. And tonight we are prepared for a very special event, taped for podcast, in front of a live and rather lively audience at the historic National Presbyterian Church in Washington, D.C. Any of you listening by podcast, if you've never been here and you're coming to the Capitol, you've got to make a stop at this church. Beautiful stained glass windows, beautiful people, and I hear pretty good preaching on Sunday morning, too. For those of you that are new to the Kindling's Muse at Earl Palmer Ministries, let me just remind you that each month Reverend Earl Palmer selects a book that every thinking Christian ought to read, and he begins with some opening comments, followed by a conversation with me, and then we open it up for questions and comments from our audience. Tonight we're going to discuss President George Washington, the man, his life journey, his greatness as an American leader, as seen through the lens of three books: David McCullough's 1776, Joseph Ellis's His Excellence, and George Washington's Rules of Civility and Decent Behavior in Company and Conversation. And speaking of civility and decent behavior, I'd like to welcome Reverend Earl Palmer. Will you join me in welcoming Earl? So tell me about Earl, about George Washington.
Well, yes, I'd like to do that. Some American heroes we know best because of what they said and what they wrote. This is certainly true of Thomas Jefferson and of Abraham Lincoln. It's true of John Adams. It's true of Benjamin Franklin. He wrote an autobiography even. It's true of James Madison and Alexander Hamilton with the Federalist Papers, but not our greatest hero. The greatest American hero, we don't know him really so much by what his words were, because the words of George Washington are few. Even at the Continental Congress in 1781, 82, 83, and 89, when he was at the Continental Congress, he basically was quiet, but his presence was overwhelming. In the Continental Congress, where the Constitution of the United States was written, he insisted that what happened in the room should not leave the room. It should be absolutely secret. He didn't want people to write notes. He didn't want them to take any pieces of paper out of the room. You think about it for a minute. We're living in an age that glorifies transparency, and yet George Washington insisted that in that Continental Congress, where the Constitution of the United States was being drafted, which has been the successful constitution of this country, he insisted on absolute secrecy in that room. And the result is this absolutely astounding document that we call the Constitution, though he said very little during those meetings. But his presence was so overwhelming in the meeting. His speeches are few. They are thoughtful. They're careful, but they're restrained. He was reverent, but he did not speak openly about his faith. He kissed the Bible after his oath of office as the first president of the United States, and he referred to God this way: as the great author, as the invisible hand. These are phrases he used to refer to the God and Father, as the intelligent and accountable being. These are phrases he used to refer to God. And on his grave is a sentence, though, from Jesus to Martha: I am the resurrection and the life. He that believeth in me, though he were dead, yet shall he live. That's on his tomb. But his words were very indirect. And he had a church he went to, a Falls Church. What he wrote was this. He said, in politics and in religion, my tenets are few and simple. And they lead one, and the leading one is to be honest and just ourselves, and to expect that from others. He wrote that. In his first inaugural address, he said, there is an indissoluble union between virtue and happiness, between duty and advantage. That's another one of his famous statements about his convictions. In his farewell address, He said, in honor of faith, he made this statement about the importance of faith in American life. He said, it's an indispensable contribution to morality and hence to political prosperity. That's what he said in his farewell address about the importance of faith in American life. He was committed to liberty of conscience in matters of religion, and he said this as president. He said, I care not if a man were a Mohammedan, a Jew, a Christian, of any sect, or an atheist. He said, I care not of that. But what I expect is responsible action and integrity. And for those of us of faith, when I think of this, of the legacy of George Washington for us of faith, I think that his insistence in that statement and other statements of an even-handedness, of a level ground, where the church or Christians or we of the people of faith are not given special favors over others, but the ground is level and civil. This is what he gave as a legacy to us, which I think is a very important gift. And I think when people ask me, what is the great gift that was given to us in the Constitution and in the legacy of George Washington, it was this insistence on the fairness and the levelness of ground so that people, for instance, he wanted the people of faith to exert moral leadership and moral presence, but not to be favored one over the other. And that is sort of his insistence, which I think is the gift he gave. Now, I want to, with those opening comments, I want to say, what formed this man? Let me tell about some of the important, what I call, formation markers of this man. He was a middle child of seven children. His father died when he was 11. Interesting, Lewis's mother died when he was 9. Tolkien's mother died when he was 9 or 10. And here, George Washington, he had a strained relationship with his own mother, especially in his teen years. But his father died when he was 11 years old. The big influence on his young life was his 14-year-old half-brother, Lawrence, who had studied in England and was a scholar and knew languages and was quite a scholar and was the family scholar and was quite an important influence on young George Washington. And George Washington himself, at the age of 15, left all formal schooling. So he had no formal schooling after age 15. Unlike John Adams was Harvard, Jefferson, all these others who were scholars. He had no formal education after age 15. He was self-educated. And the key influence then upon this young man at that point was that he made a decision at age 15 and 16 that character was the most important mark of a man. In fact, it was the last thing he said after his when he retired as president of the United States. Someone said, what's the most important marker of any leader? And he said, character. And what he meant by character as the most important mark was heavily influenced by a document that he hand-copied himself at age 16 called this Jesuit 1595 document called the Civility Code, the Rules of Civility and Decent Behavior in Company and in Conversation. And I'm going to read some of those in just a few moments. But they were terribly important. Every biographer of Washington always has to mention the importance of this 16-year-old boy copying down in his own handwriting. And by the way, this document that Jim put together for us has all of the spelling and even misspellings that George Washington had in the copying of that document in his own handwriting. It was terribly important to him. Another important thing that happened to him was that his brother, Lawrence, took him when he was in his teens to Barbados and on a trip. And in that trip to Barbados, George Washington contracted smallpox. And in fact, he carried in his face several markers of the smallpox. But the reason I'm mentioning that is, later in the Revolutionary War, when he was the general of the Revolutionary War, 100,000 of his soldiers contracted smallpox. And George Washington was immune to smallpox because he had had it as a boy in Barbados. And that's one of the reasons that contributed to the myth that he was indomitable, that no disease could touch him because of that immunity he had to smallpox. As a young man in his teens, he was 6'2". He was very handsome, very strong, and an absolutely superb horseman. He was a superb horseman his entire life. In fact, the last event of his life before he contracted what was probably strep throat and then died at age 67 was riding horses, was riding his horse. He always wiped his own horse down after he rode it. He loved his horse and loved horsemanship, and he was a great horseman. And the reason I'm mentioning that, because that plays a big part in his leadership later. Well, when he's 21 years old, now his brother Lawrence dies then, and he becomes then sort of the man of the house. But they have some property, but they're not wealthy at that point. But he has property, and they have slaves that are a part of that estate. And he's now the head of the estate at age 16. He has a strained relationship with his mother, but he has that role because his brother, his half-brother, Lawrence, is gone. At age 21, he is sent to be a messenger and to go to the French-Indian War and make contact with the French. He makes this trip as a 21-year-old boy and rides his horse, has an Indian guide go with him, makes contact, brings the message back, and then is then conscripted into the army, the British Army, and goes again to the French-Indian War, and is quickly promoted. He's now in his early 20s. He's quickly promoted to colonel, and that's what he was, Colonel Washington then, as a young man in his 20s. And in a horrible battle, the battle in which General Braddock was massacred, and in this battle, it sounds just horrible to think of it, 900 British soldiers were killed and scalped and massacred. Only 23 Frenchmen and Indians lost their lives because the battle was so one-sided. Washington was there, and Braddock totally mishandled the battle, and of course, Braddock himself was killed. But Washington stormed into this scene in his horse, took command, and rescued, by the stealth of his leadership, rescued the few British soldiers that weren't in the massacre, got them out, made sure that Braddock was buried because he was afraid Braddock would be scalped and desecrated, his body desecrated. And so this young man, this sort of heroic thing, under great danger, made sure that Braddock had been properly buried, and then came back. Though they had lost this terrible battle, he came back a hero, Colonel Washington. And then he comes back, now in his 27 years old, he then decides he better get married. He marries Martha Washington, extremely wealthy young woman. It turned out to be fortuitous, because now he's suddenly catapulted into wealth. And land becomes extremely important to him. And gathering up land, it always was a very important thing for Washington to have property. In fact, it's interesting to me that this fascination that George Washington had with land, it continued later into his presidency. And example, he wanted to be sure that the Indian tribes had their land intact, because he said the importance of soil is very important. And he insisted on that when he was president, that the Indian tribe, there were some 47,000 Indians that were in the area, in the Alleghenies, and he wanted to make sure these tribes had their land. He wanted treaties. He felt they should be treated like foreign nations, and that treaties should be made with the Indian tribes, and their land should be held intact. Unfortunately, Alexander, Andrew Jackson violated that, and the Indians were moved forcibly off of the land, and they didn't get the land. But Washington, when he was president, wanted their land protected, because Washington himself, it was so important for him to have land. Anyway, he marries Martha, and then in 1776, he is called to come to Philadelphia. And in Philadelphia, an amazing thing happens. John Adams points to this young man. He's now a young man in 1776, and says, this man, Colonel Washington, by the way, he wore his colonel's uniform. Washington was very interested in the way you looked. And he wore his colonel uniform, and John Adams said, this man should be the commander-in-chief. It's very interesting. Jefferson was in Europe at the time, and Benjamin Franklin made fun of it. Benjamin Franklin said, a planter has been made our commander-in-chief. But that we owe to John Adams. John Adams saw the brilliance and of this young colonel and felt that he had the leadership ability to be the commander-in-chief. Well, the rest is history. He became the commander-in-chief of the Revolutionary Army and took a ragtag group of volunteers and in a long 7-year war through harrowing times and finally in defeated Cornwallis. In fact, Cornwallis's men were stunned when they saw these American soldiers without shoes. And here are these British soldiers had just, we've surrendered to them. In other words, they couldn't believe that we've surrendered to these guys that don't even have shoes. But they did. And George Washington, that is the whole history. I'm not going to go into all the history of Revolutionary War, but it is amazing how that happened. And then following that, we begin to see marks of what I would call the marks of greatness. Following the war, following the Revolutionary War, he is now the hero of America, the absolute undisputed hero of the country. And two things happen that I think are absolutely amazing, and that it's now 1783, and that is that a group of his generals and officers decided to stage a revolt. And that attempt to stage a revolt called the Newburgh Revolt was really interesting. It was led by a man named Horatio Gates, who had been a young general, who always felt that he should really be the general, though Washington was the general. But he was a very ambitious young man, and so he had gathered officers together, and they were prepared to act and attempt a military takeover of this fragile Continental Congress. And for obvious reasons, the secret conversations were being held by the officers' corps. And we can be sure the crisis came to a head in March 11th when the dissident officers scheduled a meeting to coordinate their strategy. And Washington heard about it and countermanded their desire to meet together and said, no, if we're going to have a meeting, we want all the officers present. And so they had to agree. So all the officers were gathered together in March 16. And that was a very big turning point for our country because they were infuriated because the Continental Congress had not paid them their salaries, and they were prepared to take over America. And here is probably the most eloquent speech George Washington ever made. But when I read it, you're going to see it doesn't have the greatness of a Jefferson speech or the greatness of a John Adams letter. It stumbles. But it's his own handwriting, and here it is. This is his speech. He says, but I was among the... Here's his speech. I was among the first who embarked in the cause of our common country, as I have never left your side for one moment, but when called from you on public duty, as I have been the constant companion and witness of your distress, and not among the last to feel and acknowledge your merits... You can see it's clumsy, and Eddie's honoring them. As I have ever considered my own military reputation as inseparably connected with that of the Army, as my heart has ever expanded with joy when I have heard its praises, and my indignation has arisen when the mouth of distraction has been opened against it, it can scarcely be supposed at this stage of the war that I am indifferent to its interests. I mean, it's pretty clear what he's saying, but it's not particularly eloquent. And let me conjure you, in the name of our common country, and now here we're seeing the greatness of Washington, he refused to let the Army see themselves as an army, apart from the country, of our common country, let me conjure you, as you value your own sacred honor. Now we're getting stuff right out of the civility code. Your sacred honor, not your complaint that we haven't got our salary. And as you value your own sacred honor, as you respect the rights of humanity, now he's enlarging the stage. It's almost like St. Paul putting a larger and larger framework for it. As you regard the military and national character of America, he's now making it a national thing, to express your utmost horror and detestation of the man who wishes, under any specious pretenses, to overturn the liberties of our country, and who wickedly attempts, and this is the greatest line of all, who wickedly attempts to open the floodgates of civil discord and deluge our rising empire in blood. He had become very frightened of the French Revolution. He saw the French Revolution. Jefferson was glorifying it. Benjamin Franklin was silent about it. Washington was horrified by the fact that the revolutionaries became bloodthirsty. And he was worried about the deluge of the rising empire of blood. And this fragile nation was in great danger. Listen to what a man wrote who was there at that meeting. Washington just entered the new building of Newburgh, a large auditorium recently built by the troops. It was also called the Temple. 500 officers were present in the audience. Horatio Gates was chairman of the meeting, a rich irony since Gates is most probably complicit in the plot to stage a military coup that Washington has come to squash. Everything has been scripted, the orchestrated beforehand. Washington's aides fan out, this shows you the brilliance of Washington. Washington's aides fan out into the audience to prompt applause for the general's most crucial lines. Washington walks slowly to the podium, reaches inside his jacket, pulls out his prepared remarks. Then he pauses. The gesture is almost certainly planned. He pulls from his waistcoat a pair of spectacles recently sent to him by David Rittenhouse, the Philadelphia scientist. No one has ever seen Washington wear spectacles before in public. He looks out at his assembled officers while adjusting the new glasses and says, "Gentlemen, will you permit me to put on my spectacles? For I have not only grown gray, but almost blind in the service of my country." And then this writer said, several officers began to sob. The speech itself is anticlimactic. I just read the speech. But all thoughts of a military coup died at that moment. He squashed it. And then he resigned. He could have become king. He could have become anything he wanted. He had won the Revolutionary War, and he then resigned and went back to Mount Vernon and returned to his private life. And then a few years later, obviously, that is 1783. Then in 1787, he's called back. Because the war is over, and they decide to have a Continental Congress to write a constitution. And he's invited back to the Constitutional Convention, and he comes there. He goes into the convention. He insists that no piece of paper be taken outside of the convention while they're writing the constitution. And they write a constitution in at that tremendous event, and then in 1789, John Adams proposes that he be elected president, and by unanimous decision, he's elected president. John Adams is made vice president, and then he becomes. The President of the United States, and has two terms. And then after his two terms, he returns to Mount Vernon, and he writes his will in 1799, sets all his slaves free in his will, and then he dies December 12th, 1799, And one man wrote of him, first in war, first in peace, and first in the hearts of his countrymen. Henry Lee wrote that. He died at the age of 67, and that's George Washington. This amazing man who walked away from power twice and set an amazing stage for a young democracy to thrive. And I do want to end by reading some of the things he wrote in his that became major markers in his life in the Civility Code. When he was a boy, he wrote this out in his own handwriting, and it's interesting how this Civility Code, which has I'm not going to read all of them, believe me, I'm just going to take a few selected ones because they show you the character of the man, it seems to me. But the Civility Code of George Washington is 110. There are 110 markers. It was a document that came out of it was written by a Jesuit, and was in France, and he used it something maybe as a penmanship thing, but he copied every single bit of it, and it meant a great deal to him. And here are some of the great Civility Code markers that he had. Number one is, every action done in company ought to be with some sign of respect to those who are present. Here's another one. Sleep not when others speak. Sit not when others stand. Speak not when you should hold your peace, and walk not when others stop. Here's another one. When you sit down, keep your feet firm and even, without putting one foot on the other or crossing them. He had all these are just markers that were in his life. Let your discourse with men and business be short and comprehensive. And that Washington followed all his life. People of low degree ought not to use ceremonies to lords and others of high degree, but respect the highest honor and highly honor them. And those of high degree ought to treat them with affability and courtesy without arrogance. And then, in speaking to men of quality, do not lean or look them full in the face, nor approach too near, but keep a full pace from them. And let thy ceremonies be courtesy and proper to the dignity of the place, for it's absurd to act the same with a clown or with a prince. And when a man does all he can, though it succeeds not well, blame him not that he did it. And be not hasty to believe flying reports to the disparagement of anyone. Associate yourself with men of good quality if you esteem your own reputation, for 'tis better to be alone than to be in bad company. Never express anything unbecoming, nor act angst against the rules moral before your inferiors. And then, go not thither where you know not whether you shall be welcome or not. Give not advice without being asked, and then do it briefly. Speak not in an unknown tongue. He didn't like people who knew all, he didn't know any languages like that. I mean, John Adams knew five languages, but he did like John Adams. Speak not in an unknown tongue in company, but in your own language, and that of those of quality. Do not use vulgar, the vulgar or the sublime matters. Treat seriously. And when another speaks, be attentive yourself, and disturb not the audience if any hesitates in his words. Help him not, don't prompt him, interrupt him not, and don't answer until his speech is ended. And undertake not what you cannot perform, but be careful to keep your promise. In disputes, be not desirous to overcome as to not give liberty to each one to deliver his opinion, and submit to the judgment of the major party, especially if the judges are in a dispute. So it's just one, but I'll read the last. The last few are kind of very touching. Set not yourself at the upper end of the table, but if it be your due or that of the master of the house, and if he has it so, then contend not, lest you should trouble the company. In other words, sit where you're told to sit. And when you speak of God or of his attributes, let it be seriously and with reverence. Honor and obey your natural parents, although they be poor. And then the last two, let your recreations be manful, not sinful. And the final one, labor to keep alive in your breast that little spark of celestial fire called conscience. That's about the only religious elements in all of the 110 of the rules of civility and decent behavior. But they were very key influences in his life.
Absolutely. Thank you, Earl. We're going to be back with more of Earl Palmer, the Kindling's Muse at Earl Palmer Ministries right after this. Thanks for joining us. Everybody, this is Dick Staub, host of the Kindling's Muse, where we're enjoying a conversation tonight with Earl Palmer of Earl Palmer Ministries. He's also the interim preaching pastor at the National Presbyterian Church in Washington, D.C., and that's where we're broadcasting from tonight. A wonderful discussion about George Washington, and we've been inspired by the comments that have been made already. And if you'd like to read more, you can read Joseph Ellis's His Excellency or David McCullough's 1776. Reverend Palmer also mentioned George Washington's rules of civility and decent behavior, which I'd say just about everybody in this country could benefit from reading again, and particularly my generation and younger, I'll say. The thing about Washington, and I always appreciate doing these shows because it gives me a chance to reread these books and be reminded of some of the things that you see in them. And the interesting thing about George Washington was that not only was he a man who had a sense of his own destiny, but other people noticed it about him. And it is interesting because you've already pointed out that Washington wasn't a man of words. He wasn't one that talked a lot. People formed their opinions about him by watching him in action. What do you think it was that people saw in him that made them feel that he had a leadership possibility, that he had a destiny, that he should fill these key roles?
Well, yeah, he's tall, and
well, that's me. You know what's interesting though is I get the impression when I read 1776 and some of the books of that era that Americans weren't quite so tall back then. That 6'2" was a taller than a lot of men were at that time,
right,
in the colonies.
Yes. So he was tall, and I think he was a very handsome man, and he was a man of few words, and this becomes it's an interesting marker because all these other people that surround him in the American Revolution and the American Dream were more highly educated than he was, and that's why I think that's why in a sense he's mocked by Benjamin Franklin and others. Who is this guy? John Adams is the one exception. And John Adams, that's why I have so much respect for John Adams. He spotted the greatness of this young man, George Washington, and he's the one that wanted him to become the commander in chief. And of course, then he got rewarded because John Adams, of course, was George Washington's vice president. And it's interesting, George Washington noticed John Adams's son, John Quincy Adams. And one of the last things Washington did was to say that he wanted him appointed to a position, even though Adams was resisting it because Adams was going to become president. But Washington said, no, your son should be put into a position. One of the last things Washington did was to make sure that John Quincy Adams, who later became president also, that he would be promoted. But George Washington, he spotted leaders, and he had a great instinct. He had a natural instinct, it seems to me,
Yeah, I was pointing out to Daniel, your study assistant this year, how many of the leaders of the revolution were in their 20s? And it's, you see a 41-year-old man in George Washington, 43 years old, I think, who nevertheless was going around tapping the shoulder of these young potential soldiers, most of whom didn't have any experience. I mean, he had some experience. Washington had some experience, but it was mostly failed experiences. But he did have a rank. But he was willing to hand off leadership to these younger people. The other thing that it seems like people saw in Washington, he was obviously perseverant. I mean, he was a man that was willing to stick through no matter what. And he had an amazing capacity for pragmatism. There were many times when Washington was recommending certain military actions in which the others around him disagreed with him, and he would defer to their judgment. He viewed leadership pragmatically. He wanted to get the best result. He was willing to hear different opinions. And he wasn't just an idealist, which he frankly thought some of the more educated elite in the movement were, that they were a little bit too idealistic and weren't quite so pragmatic. It's interesting to see how that was spotted by different people. One of the biographers of Washington said he could be counted on to say little but do the right thing. That sounds like a campaign slogan, doesn't it? Say little but do the right thing. That sounds pretty good to me.
Well, when you think of the, I'm really impressed with the rules that he had now the clout to be able to do it when the writing of the United States Constitution was underway, that he wanted no papers to go out of the room. He didn't want people to talk outside the room. He wanted it within the room. He wanted them to, and he himself evidently played very little part in framing it, except that he established that rule and held to it and protected, you might say, the privacy of decision making, and gave that this new republic, gave it the chance to think through. And of course, the U.S. Constitution that was written is a stroke of genius, and it really is, because it works, and Washington gets credit for that, that he preserved that order in the midst of that.
Well, you see some of his rules of civility coming through in Constitutional Congress when, for instance, you said he didn't say much, but he was willing to hear everybody else out. And another thing you see is when there were rumors that were started against him, one of his rules of civility was to wait and see what the facts are in every situation. He had that ability, and that really held the country in good stead because he was a pretty steady person at that time.
And, of course, we just touched on this, but the protection of this country from a military, you might say, coup d'etat, from the young ambitious guys that wanted to... And the way he outmaneuvered them, and he just simply did not want that. He did not want the French Revolution. He was very frightened of the French Revolution, and whereas others were enamored by it, he was not enamored by it because there was a cruelty in it. There was a chaos in it. The fact that he wanted the proper burial of people, he wanted things to be done the way when he arranged to make sure that his general was properly buried so he wouldn't be scalped, he wanted to protect that honor, and he's just a young man at that time, but he felt that, and that sort of dignity he felt.
Well, that dignity that he viewed as a more of a Southern quality, he found the New Englanders frankly pretty uncouth when he saw the New England troops were being brought in, because he was very self-disciplined, and he expected that kind of discipline in the ranks of the troops, and they didn't really show it, but over time, that military group took on that mark. Where did this self-control come from in Washington? You see him described as a passionate man who seemed restrained. So it wasn't that he didn't have passions, but he restrained his passions. He actually is described in many places as a very ambitious man, and somewhat proud man who nevertheless learned humility. If there is a word that describes Washington, it is self-discipline, self-controlled. Where did that come from?
Well, I just think it's probably the biggest, you might say, ideological influence on his life is the rules of civility, which are really interesting. They were written mainly probably by Roman Catholic Jesuits in France, and he found them. They were given to him, and he read them, and he copied them all with his own handwriting. And there's a lot of misspellings in the because he was a self-educated young man, and yet that sense of I only read a few of them, but they're all there's a sense of honor, of civility, and of and restraint that just simply became very formative in his character.
One of the most touching comments in Ellis is when Ellis says that Washington had a supreme ability to sublimate his ego. So much so that he points out in one situation where it was very clear that winning the war was more important than being himself. And I think about today's penchant for self-expression and, you know, I have to be who I am. And here's a man who knew who he was and was willing for the good of others and for the good of the country and for the good of the cause to sublimate who he was and to suppress his ego. And you see this comes throughout in those rules of civility where self-control, self-discipline.
And of course, the most baffling thing for any political scientist is to see a man who, by personal choice, decided to walk away from power.
Yeah,
it's just unprecedented. Nobody did it. You just don't walk away from power, and he did. He did it twice. He did it after the Revolutionary War when he had been the conqueror, and he walked away from it. And also, he outmaneuvered young officers that wanted to take over. But he did that, and then of course when he was president, he could have been president for life. He could have. They were setting the rules, and he walked away from it again, and went back to Mount Vernon, and wanted to go back to being just who he was. And so that was that wonderful gift he gave of restraint, of personal restraint of power.
Well, King George III had something to say about that willingness to walk away from power.
And he couldn't believe it.
King George III said if he actually retires when he wins this war, if he wins this war, he would be the greatest man in the world. And then Washington did it. And that's a pretty amazing tribute from the king that you're rebelling against.
But also, I just did the little bit about the fact that he wanted American Indians, even though he himself had was horrified by the scalping that was done of the soldiers, when they lost that terrible battle, and yet he wanted no vengeance on that, and he wanted to preserve their integrity. And again, he's just a young man that saw this. And now, later, it didn't happen because of the westward expansion of America. The people wanted all the lands the Indians had. But he wanted that preserved, that sense of honor.
What do you think George Washington meant when he described himself as a man of destiny? And where did his sense of destiny originate?
Well, his brother was very influential in his life, that's when he did get contracted this dreadful disease, and yet he got over it. But his brother was a very big influence in his life, and not really his father, because his father was dead before Washington really had a chance to be under the influence of his father, and it was his brother, his half brother. And then I'm trying to think of what these great influences in Washington's life. It was that brother for sure. It was this civility code that he copied out and made so much a part of his life. And
another one of the rules in the civility code was if someone fails to not be too hard on them. And he had to do that. I mean, how many of you have read 1776 or have read some of these? I mean, when you read these books, you are just amazed at how many setbacks this man had and how often he was both willing to admit that he had made the wrong decision and learn from it and go back again, that perseverance. When some of his officers failed as young men, he could have replaced them, but he didn't. He would give them another chance. He had a lot of those natural abilities, and I think when you read the Civility Code, and by the way, I think those of you here in the live audience, they have some here tonight, and they're well worth picking up and reading and studying and even thinking about applying to our own lives. You know, I remember, it's funny, when you were doing your introduction of George Washington, and you pointed out that he's self-educated. He didn't have a lot of formal education. He wasn't a great orator. He wasn't a career politician. He had very clear beliefs and convictions that grew out of his own sense of what was right and issues of character. And then you think about fast-forwarding candidate George Washington into the contemporary scene. And I'm thinking about George Will's book, Statecraft as Soulcraft. And he does a good job in that book of defending the profession of governance and the political life as a worthy calling and profession. I wonder what we learn, if anything, from Washington about, you know, can such a person have a role today in political life? Someone that doesn't have a lot of formal education, someone that isn't a great orator, someone that is committed simply to trying to understand what the right thing is and do it, or are things too complex today? I mean, was this a man that was great in his own time but might not have been great in another era?
And, well, I thought about that. I do think the qualities, the character qualities that are here are applicable to any generation. There is this self-restraint. There is this tremendous sense of honor. There is this the sense of building up others around you, and yet being a private person, keeping your own thoughts, and knowing your limitations. So that it's interesting, isn't it, that he didn't want. Here we're writing the Constitution of the United States, and he doesn't want people to go outside the room and start the rumors out there. He wanted it all inside the room. He wanted to preserve that, the integrity of that event, and he pulled it off by the sheer force of his personality. If there was a scrap of paper that somebody had written, he said, "Whose is that?" And people were in terror that they'd say, "Oh." Because that was not to leave the room. They were to do it within that room. And he pulled that off without leakage outside. And that was the force of kind of a restraint. It was a great gift that he gave to America.
You know, there was one really interesting passage, and I think it was in McCullough, where he portrayed George Washington as someone who really knew how to play a role. He was meeting with the British, and they were, talking about the possibility of some sort of reconciliation. And he gave this speech that showed this measured, proper response. But then, as soon as the British left the room, you know, everybody knew that Washington was basically playing the role of the negotiator, but that he didn't really think, you know, that there was a possibility of this happening. And it is interesting how much Washington placed on appearance, demeanor, the way you conducted yourself in public. He took it very seriously, the way he was treating other people and the way they would perceive him. And on this, how did people notice him? How did they? Well, he dressed differently. He carried himself more carefully than other people. He was a man of few words, but the words that he said tended to get people's attention. I mean, you get this sense of this very centered person that knows who he is, knows what he believes, and yet, unlike our culture today doesn't seem to feel the need to continually express it and impose it on other people, but to show restraint and to be patient in the execution of his own ideas and plans.
Yeah, I think that's well put. And the lack of, it's funny, there is a strong ego here and a strong powerful leadership, but yet he's not desperate to have the leadership. He's not desperate to hold on to it. I mean, he walks away from it twice. It's just unprecedented. And in a way, that enables this great republic to start with shared leadership and becomes a real democracy then. And we owe a tremendous debt to that ability to restrain and to not need all of this, this power, and to walk away from it too.
Well, it's a wonderful study of a most fascinating man, and now we're going to take a quick break and be back with our live audience with their questions and comments about George Washington. Tonight we're visiting with Earl Palmer. George Washington, the man, his life journey, his greatness as an American leader, and reading these books and hearing this discussion gives us a lot to be thankful for in this country. We're going to be back with more right after this. This is Dick Staub back with you. You're listening to Kindling's Muse, live from Earl Palmer Ministries. Tonight we're broadcasting from the National Presbyterian Church, where I assume I'm looking at a lot of Presbyterians in the live audience. One of my favorite stories I've told this to Earl is, what does a Presbyterian do at Thanksgiving dinner? The Presbyterian starts by saying, would someone read the minutes of the last Thanksgiving dinner? And that's how you know you're at a Presbyterian Thanksgiving. And I suspect that happened at the first Thanksgiving, too. There was a Presbyterian influence there, I'm sure of it. Well, we're so glad to be with you here tonight, and we're looking forward to some of the questions and comments that you have. And we're going to get started right over here. If you could just tell us your first name and then ask your question.
My name is Gail, and thank you very much. This is delightful. You began this wonderful history by saying that you consider George Washington to be the greatest American hero, and you've given us a lot of the attributes. Could you briefly explain why you give him that title of the greatest American hero, George Washington? Thank you.
Well, I think because you have to get credit for being the father of the country and setting in motion so many of the a hero. Not only because he was heroic, but because of the wisdom of the way he decided to deport the beginning of his, you might say, leadership, a gift to America. He could have done it like in the French Revolution, which was bloody and self-serving and vindictive. And he doesn't do that. There's a leadership style that is... in my opinion, favors the what becomes the constitutional democracy of shared leadership and of fairness, and we see it in the Constitution. It was written in that amazing. He gets a lot of credit, though. He didn't talk much. He didn't say a lot, and his speeches, I've read just one of those, they're not that inspirational because the wording is awkward compared to reading Jefferson or reading John Adams and the other great, more eloquent people. But there was the force of his personality by the time of when the revolution is over, he could have taken this country in such a myopic direction of his own heroism or of his own design. And instead, he steps back and brings these brilliant people together. And let's face it, the framers of our Constitution were an amazing collection of people. And who could have brought them together? And who could have been a good enough listener, like George Washington was, to defer to them and yet insist that nobody walk outside the room and start talking outside with other people about what we're going to talk about in there, and force them to talk about it within that room? And it really is an amazing achievement. And I just don't know that I think it's unprecedented. And we owe a great debt to that.
Well, the combination of both winning the Revolutionary War and being the first president, this is what David McCullough says. He points out that by the time the war ended, it had taken the lives of an estimated 25,000 Americans, or roughly 1% of our population. I just think about 1% of our entire population. In percentage of lives lost, it was the most costly war in American history, except for the Civil War. And then McCullough says, without Washington's leadership and unrelenting perseverance, the Revolution almost certainly would have failed. As Nathaniel Greene foresaw as the war went on, he will be the deliverer of his own country. I mean, we wouldn't exist as a nation if it wasn't for George Washington. I mean, I think that's a kind of a starting point, and why would he be considered one of our greatest heroes? We have another question over here. First name and your question.
Yes, my name is Alex, and George Washington, as the father of our country, ironically had no natural children of his own. What effect do you think, if any, that had on Washington as a leader?
Yeah, there's Martha had these two children, a boy who dies he dies as a young man, and is not successful as a young man before he dies, and then the daughter dies young, and George Washington, so he had no children of his own. But he treasured these two children that Martha had, and was but yet they died very young, and it's a kind of a sadness there of this whole family. You know, is you don't have any children, and yet
do you have a theory as to how it might have affected affected him?
Well, I think one thing, he was able to so completely devote his energies for so many years to the country, as giving birth to the country. I mean, I don't want to get too...
Well, but that's the lines my thinking was going, because I've been gone a lot the last 2 weeks, and my wife feels I've been gone too much.
Yeah.
And this is a man that spent a decade of his life, you know, out of his own home. And you can tell how much he loved his home, because in the midst of battles, you'd find him in the journal writing notes and letters back home to tell them what to do about the chimney and how to take care of the flocks. And I mean, very attentive to the details back home. But I think it's an interesting question in terms of how children would have affected his ability to pour his energies so completely. But I think it also goes to a point of self-discipline. You know, even with children, he seems like the kind of man that if he felt this is what he was supposed to do, he probably would have done it.
You know, interesting thing about Washington, too, is a lot of people make the comment about how obsessed he was about land. And he was. That meant a great deal to him, land, and the acquisition of land. And there are some critical things said about even some land deals he did with people to get even more land for Mount Vernon and all. But yet, isn't it touching that he was feeling so deep that the American Indians should have land, and that they and it should be theirs? And now, unfortunately, that did not happen the same way that he had hoped. But he had this. He was totally focused on land in a very big way. And but you know, he wasn't really greedy. He served as the commander-in-chief of the Revolutionary War with no salary. And that was his own decision, no salary for his service. Now and he wasn't really that wealthy, except he did have land. And that was wealth, because that was because really of his wife. She's the one that had wealth. And as you know, when he died, one of the last things Washington did was, of course, to set free all his slaves. And the last person really to hear Washington's words was one of his slaves who loved him. And in fact, the last words of George Washington was to this one slave. He says, "Sit down, you're tired." And then he died himself. He set his slaves free. It's in his will. It's a very touching part of his will. But he couldn't do the land without all these slaves that ran his land. But he had a hands-on approach to his land. He's totally focused on his land, and wanted very much to have land in the hands of people.
He was a man with valuable real estate and a cash flow problem, something that sounds familiar today. Right over here, we have a question.
Thank you. My name is David. There seems to be a continued controversy over the role Christianity or Jesus Christ played in the life of George Washington. A lot of secular historians say, yeah, he kind of believed, but he just went to church because everybody did, where, you know, a lot of people of faith think he was really driven by God's word. What would be your reaction, and where do you see the kind of controversy going?
Well, that's why I sort of started a little bit on that. I wanted to say that part of his journey. I think he had a faith. He had a church. He attended. He doesn't talk about his faith very much, but he doesn't talk about anything very much. I mean, he uses indirect phrases. He kissed the Bible when he was inaugurated, and not every president's done that, but he chose to do that. And he was reverent, but yet he didn't talk about it. He used indirect ways of referring. So some people say, well, maybe he was just a deist. But then, yet, on the other hand, Martha maybe, because Martha's probably the one that decided what was put on his tomb, which is our Lord's statement, "I am the resurrection and the life." You know, he that believeth in me, you know, though he were dead, yet shall he live. George Washington is amazing. And I've become convinced he was a very private man, a very private man. And he did not want to wear things on his sleeve too much. And yet, I think he had faith. And he was a man. He didn't go to church, and he had faith. Maybe his wife had more faith than he did. He's not a big talker. And so he's going to be a big disappointment to everyone that wants sound bites. I mean, today journalists would be up the wall with Washington because he would give them no sound bites. And I decided to read that one statement, which is a great statement where he puts down a revolt, but it's not very inspiring the way he does it.
Well, Joseph Ellis summarizes his answer to that question this way. He says, "Washington was a lukewarm Episcopalian. He never took communion, tended to talk about providence rather than God, preferred standing rather than kneeling when praying." George Washington. However, on the plane yesterday, I was finishing up the book, having read it earlier in my life and coming back to it, the book 1776, and the guy next to me said, "I read that book." And I said, "Well, what do you remember about the book? What impressed you?" And he said, "What impressed me is how we came so close to not winning our freedom. How so many fortuitous things happened when the British did really stupid things." But they said, "But I also got the sense throughout David McCullough's book of divine providence in what happened in the war." And Washington understood that. For those of you that have studied that war, there were a number of times where the weather was the deciding factor in what was going to happen in the outcome of a given battle. And the weather was often described in the journals of the soldiers there as miraculous. The wind changing so that the British ships couldn't come in. A torrential downpour the cloud seems just stuck over the enemy. And these kinds of stories that are historical records of the accounts. And Washington definitely saw that as providence of the author of the outcome. And he felt that the country had a destiny, and that that destiny was from the author. But for people looking for an evangelical who could say he knew the four spiritual laws, you're not going to find it in Washington. Another question over here.
Yes, thank you very much. My name is Chris. I wanted to ask, did George Washington have buddies or a circle of friends that he would meet with that influenced him, that nurtured him, and that he ran ideas past?
Yes, I think you'd have to say Alexander Hamilton is the very trusted. It's funny, John Adams is his vice president, but he didn't. Washington started the tradition of not paying much attention to his vice president, which every president since then has followed. And yet he had great respect for John Adams, and he owes everything to John Adams. It was John Adams who was the key to him becoming the commander in chief, and it was John Adams who had so much respect for George Washington. And George Washington, as I told you, adored John Adams' son, John Quincy Adams, and wanted to make sure, one of the last things he made sure was that John Quincy Adams, would be promoted. And but I think it would be Alexander Hamilton was his confidant, and he had so much respect for him. And Jefferson, no. I think maybe Washington was suspicious of Jefferson. I know Adams was suspicious of Jefferson. But though the beautiful thing about, I love the book John Adams, is the rekindling of friendship between Thomas Jefferson and John Adams. Though I think John Adams is the greater man, in my opinion, than Thomas Jefferson. But Jefferson always looked down on Washington, and actually said that he felt that he was getting feeble-minded, which was not true at all. But he ran him down in many ways. But, yeah, and, well, you know, the great friend was the French. Washington had a great friendship for French Lafayette. And that young man, he was a young man, 21 years old, and Washington had great respect for him. And
did we have another question over on this side?
Gene, and I was wondering if you had any comment to make about this vision that George Washington had during the Revolutionary War.
Explain which one that would that be?
Well, the one where he sort of got a bird's eye view of the future of the United States.
You tell me what it is. I'm not aware of that.
I don't remember it all, but I'll have to get you a copy.
Is that an apocryphal account? There are tremendous apocryphal accounts about Washington, and that may be one. It's not in the biographies that I've read that would be a. Now there's a tremendous amount of apocryphal material about Washington, because he is a great national hero. And it's interesting to me that one of the reasons there are so many, in fact, this book starts by discounting a whole bunch of apocryphal accounts of Washington, is because he didn't say much. And so you don't have a lot of things that he said that are quoted from him. His speeches are short and I think they're effective and moving, but he invites a lot of what we would call apocryphal accounts of him, but he was there was no question about the brilliance of his leadership, though, and no question about the wisdom of his presidency as the first president of the United States, of the formation of a great constitution for our country that has been able to work for us, and then of course these little things that I just made reference to, the wanting fairness for the American Indians. Now Andrew Jackson didn't follow that. Andrew Jackson actually is the one that is responsible for most of the Indians losing all their the rights to have property. Washington wanted them to have property. And wanted and felt that they had manifest destiny too, and he saw that, And another thing, Washington, it's kind of ironic. The one thing that was so much on his heart was that America would have a university that would be founded as an American university. Well, there is an American university here in Washington, D.C., but he wanted a university. And that was a dream that Congress was cool to, everybody was cool to, nobody went for, because he himself had not had. He had not gone to school. And so he wanted schooling so much. And that was one of his dreams. But again, what a dream that was for America and how we have benefited from that dream that everybody would have a chance to be educated and educated well. So again, that was his dream. So there are just so many of these legacies that I just found my... He just... the more I read about this man, the more I was endeared to him. And I'm glad of that because... you know, because he didn't, you know, Lincoln made marvelous speeches. And Jefferson has got these great words of the Declaration of Independence and stuff that we give Jefferson credit for. But we don't have that with Washington. Instead, we have this brave man who had this respect for this young republic and did not want it to go a monarchical route where he could have become king or could have become a dictator. He chose not to do that. He chose to preserve this constitution that was being written and to preserve that integrity, set his slaves free. There's a lot written on why didn't he do it earlier? Well, that's a question, but that's his last will. Was to make sure his slaves would all be set free, and not just set free, taken care of in terms of the ones that were ill and all. There was that wonderful side to this man, and I just felt that humanity of Washington is what became clear to me in these books.
These are great books to read. We recommend them to everybody, and Washington, one biographer said, understood that his place in history would be enhanced if instead of enlarging his power, he surrendered it. And he did that twice, and that's a big accomplishment in itself. This is Dick Staub. You've been listening to Kindling's Muse live from the National Presbyterian Church. Our guest has been Earl Palmer. We've been talking about 1776 by David McCullough and His Excellency by Joseph Ellis, and of course, the document that Washington copied himself and tried to apply in his daily life, Rules of Civility and Decent Behavior. This is Dick Staub. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time on the Kindling's Muse.